Blog Talk Radio.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on Deport from 29 District. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
Hello and welcome to Provocative Thought, intimately known as PT, striving to awaken those who are asleep, stimulate those who are awakened, feed those who are starving, and nurture those who seek to know. I am your host, Carlton Steed, a self-proclaimed student of life in the search, discovery, and revelation of life on life's terms. First, I'd like to thank We Talk Productions for allowing me to host this show. I'd also like to thank the creator for allowing me to be. You can contact the show by dialing 516-531-9540. Please press the number one to speak. You can contact the show by dialing 516-531-9540. Please press the number one to speak. You can reach us on the internet at www.blogtalkradio.com. Go to search and type in We Talk Productions and listen to the show live. You can also contact us on Facebook at Provocative Thought PT Community Organization. Tonight's topic, did desegregation weaken the black collective? Many say that desegregation opened doors for black Americans, and many say desegregation marked this integration of collective black economics, the disintegration of black collective economics. So what do you say? There are some disadvantages and some advantages afforded black people during segregation and desegregation in America, right? Did black people lose something while gaining something? Is that possible? IPL.org says Jim Crow laws were state and local statutes that legalized the racial segregation, right? Separation, blacks from whites. Blacks over there, whites over here, whites have better, blacks have second class, whatever, right? Not as good as the whites, folks, right? Enacted after the Civil War, the laws denied equal opportunity to black citizens. African Americans were treated as second class citizens. I'm going to say after the Civil War, they was treated like dirt. Second class citizen, that's a one up, because just read. It was a time when African Americans couldn't be equal to a Caucasian, right? So right after the Civil War, get a whole lot of, they did what they wanted to do to a black person, right up until the 60s and the 70s and present time, right? We can make a little noise now, but back then it was very difficult. It was more difficult, right? From blackleaderanalysis.com, they said that economic disenfranchisement began in the 1600s. Maryland was the first state to make a black exclusion edict in 1665. The Black Exclusion Edict codified the treatment of blacks as second-class citizens and made it illegal for blacks to participate in the economy. In this case, some of you guys might realize that 1600s of black people were still slaves in this country, right? All right, so the Civil Rights Movement resulted in affirmative action. Matter of fact, this is... Claude Anderson, this is coming from Claude Anderson. Dr. Claude Anderson wrote many of the original affirmative action laws as part of the Carter administration. Now, I've read or heard him say that was originally written for, specifically for black folks. When you talk about laws being made specifically to address the problems of black people, this is affirmative action. Dr. Claude Anderson wrote specifically to help black people. It says, since the inception, affirmative action has grown to include more people. Currently, white women get 70% of affirmative action jobs, and Hispanics get 20% of the affirmative action jobs. Blacks receive about 1% of the benefit from affirmative action, right? Dr. Anderson hopes to a speedy end of affirmative action. That's something he is a contributor, major contributor, right? He said the influx of immigrants also caused the relative pay between whites and blacks to stay at 54%. Jobs can be given to immigrants to fill AA quotas, and disenfranchisement of blacks will continue. The percent of national wealth owned by black people in 1860, he said, was about 0.5%. In 1960, the number went up 1.5%. Currently, he said, we still have less than 2% of the national wealth. We are not doing any better as a group, which is the key word here, as a group of people. right? Because I know everybody, some people might be saying this is the melting pot and we're all in this together. According to Mr. Anderson, that's not the way the race is ran, okay? He said the lack of wealth in the black community is not the result of any inferiority on the part of black people, which if you're black, you know that, right? In 1860, 98% of the black population was illiterate. By 1900, only 40% were literate. I'm going to say that again because of what's going on in the school system and these underserved communities, black communities and things like that. In 1860, 98% of the black population was illiterate. By 1900, only 40% were literate. There's a rapid growth of literacy in the black community, right? He said that was one of the greatest achievements in education history. Black men, black women are the most educated demographic in America, he said, at this point. However, this does not translate into wealth or even income due to discrimination in the marketplace, right? So we still have these things going on, discrimination. We have desegregation laws, but we still continue to have discrimination, right? So black and whites had separate laws governing social, economic, and political interacting, right? These laws allow whites to discriminate against black people, degrade and belittle them, just as they had been doing so since chattel slavery, right? This is one time when they actually did legislate what was a man's heart. Still, while separate, right? And under segregation, blacks thrived with America's foot on their neck. Some say a common oppressive enemy forced black people to work together, to work hard, as their survival depended upon their success or what success they could achieve, right? So that's like, you know, I force you to live together. Therefore, you work together as a result of being forced to be in proximity to each other, right? You got to ask, why isn't that happening now? Anyway, but we're going to keep going. There's a lot of reasons why it's not happening now. From NBC News, U.S. neighborhoods are more segregated than a generation ago. That's 40 years. A generation is 40 years, right? U.S. neighborhoods are more segregated than a generation ago, perpetuating racial inequity, right? We often overlook one of the root causes in staggering disparities in health, income, and, you know, things like that, right? Time. I'm just show you different people writing about this so you don't think I'm just pulling this out of the air. And these are mainstream folks right here, right? Time. The U.S. is increasingly diverse. So why is segregation getting worse? Right? The Guardian. Residential segregation exacerbates many national problems. In education, a black-white achievement gap persists largely because the poorest pupils are concentrated in racially homogeneous schools where instruction is overwhelmed by children's out-of-school challenges, right? They have they come into school with issues, traumatized, they're not eating at home, you know, whatever. Abuse, deaths, homicides, and being, you know, exposed to a whole lot of things, right? These schools are segregated because their neighborhoods are segregated, right? Somehow, even though they passed the law, things are still segregated. It's amazing, right? From Brookings, EDU, right? Neighborhood segregation persists for black, Latino, or Hispanic and Asian Americans. 1968, the Fair Housing Act outlawed blatant discriminatory practices by lenders, realtors, and government agencies. White neighborhoods continue to remain whiter than their surrounding metropolitan areas. It is also the case that neighborhoods where the average Black, Latino, or Hispanic and Asian American population reside continue to include overrepresentations of those groups. So it sounds like people are being herded into communities or herd themselves into communities. I don't know. But somebody once told me anytime you see something that continually happens is not a coincidence. So from the U.S. News, segregation's legacy. 50 years after the Fair Housing Act was signed, America is nearly as segregated as when President Lyndon Johnson signed the law. TheGuardian.com, again, right? America is still segregated. We need to be honest about why. So I'm not reading these whole articles. I'm just reading snippets from different articles that speak to how America continues to be segregated, even though a law was passed, a desegregation law was passed. It's a growing inequality partly reflects a racial wealth gap. Growing inequality, right, partly reflects a racial wealth gap. That wealth gap, that's the thing we're talking about here, right? Middle-class white Americans are more likely to live in neighborhoods with rising home values, with rising, going up, prices going up, right? And thus creating family equity, right? While middle-class Black counterparts are more likely to rent or live in a neighborhood with stagnant values and prices. So what's that all about? That sounds like a real estate people not playing fair. Let's just say that for now. Anyway, hostile, sometimes fatal confrontations between police and African-American youth might be rarer if the poorest young people were not concentrated in neighborhoods lacking well-resourced schools, good jobs, and transportation to better opportunities, right? All right. In integrated neighborhoods with substantial middle-class population, police perform as public servants, not as an occupying force. Basically, that just means they're nicer, right? They treat them differently, and less underserved neighborhoods, they are very forceful, right? So maybe they're very fearful, and so they're forceful. And who knows? Maybe they're very racist and therefore forceful. Who knows what the problem is? But it's a population that basically, shall I say, second class? But they're not supposed to be second class. Sounds like we got that second-class citizenship thing still going on. You know what I'm saying? We've done little to desegregate the neighborhoods, he says, believing their racial homogeneity is de facto tied to private prejudice, personal choices, realtor discrimination, or income differences, right, that made middle-class suburbs unaffordable to most African-Americans. So under our constitutional system, if neighborhoods are segregated by private activity, we can do little about it. Did y'all know that? Because I didn't. You can do it. You can segregate privately, right? I bet you could lose, I guess, how would that work? I guess that includes, that's like a contradiction. Because the only way you can do that, you got to have the realtors working with you. And the realtor is not supposed to discriminate under the Fair Housing Act. So how does that work? If only our neighborhoods are segregated and called by de jure, by explicit government policy, right? And so the law that the desegregation law, then you can act against it, right? And I guess the government will back you on that. Indeed, the Constitution requires remedies for this situation, right? De jure. So I guess that's a French word, by explicit government policy. Sounds like some double talk to me. You know, I'm not the sharpest knife in the kitchen, but I know when I'm hearing double talk. Double talk. That's what I call it. When somebody says you can't do something and then you can do something. Come on. Anyway, from the busfoundation.org, on June 5th, 1956, a Montgomery federal court ruled that any law requiring racially segregated seating on buses violated the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The Montgomery bus boycott was successful in establishing the goal of integration. Now, if you don't know that, Martin Luther King and the brothers over the country refused to ride the bus after, I don't know how I'm forgetting her name. She's very, what's the sister's name? She refused to give up her seat on the bus. Rosa Parks. She got tired. She's tired. She didn't want to give her seat up on the bus to a white man, right? So they said, hey, we're going to boycott the buses. And I guess money talks and all that other stuff walks. Because that made the powerful ones take a look at the situation. Somebody decided, hey, I'm losing too much money. Y'all better do something, right? And I guess they worked it out in court. Whoever got paid, and here we are with this Civil Rights Act. That's my take on it. Anyway, Montgomery bus boycott was a successful enterprise to put on full display the influence of the African-American dollar. So the author here says the Montgomery bus boycott, right? We ain't riding your buses, you ain't getting our money because you got to pay to ride the bus, right? So he considered that as a full display of the influence of the African-American dollar. It has been suggested that the boycott cost the city of Montgomery $3,000 a day. At the time of the boycott, African Americans made up of about 45% of the population. 75% of the people who rode the buses were African American, which means they were losing 75% of their revenues. Right? Montgomery City Lines lost between 30,000 and 40,000 bus fares each day during the boycott. The bus company that operated the city busing had suffered financially from the 7-month-long boycott. For 7 months, they were walking, helping each other get to places, riding bikes, I guess, and, buddying up in the cars, taxiing or whatever they got to work, right? They were helping each other, right? They had a common enemy. And they were working together, right? Anyway, it was a 7-month-long boycott, and the city became desperate to end the boycott, right? Because of that money, right? Local police began to harass Dr. King and the other leaders, right? So first, much respect to Medgar Evers, Martin Luther King, and the Civil Rights Movement gang. Black people were long overdue recognition and protection under the law as U.S. citizens, right? They say hindsight is 20/20, and a full display of the power of the black dollar would actually be to support and perpetuate a transportation system by black people for black people, but not necessarily exclusively for black people. So you get 75% of the ridership already, right? And I'm sure some white folks going to want to catch the bus, right? So to me, that would be a full display of the power of the black dollar. It would be to support, to perpetuate a transportation system by black people, for black people, but not necessarily exclusively for black people, right? Why settle for 75% of the ridership when you can get 80 or 90%? And if whites never ride, there will just be that much room on the bus. Can't worry about that, right? Sure, it's degrading to have to give your seat up to a white person or sit only in the back of the bus just because you're black. It is dehumanizing and unconstitutional, right? Maybe slavery, Jim Crow, and segregation had beat some of us in the head so hard that success became defined as having anything white folks had and had forbidden black folks to have. Good or better was having anything white folks had or desired. The gold standard had become to become like white folks, riding, eating, shoulder to shoulder at the counter or on the bus to success. Assimilating into the social economic pool of white is rightness became an objective while neglecting the value of black collective social political economics or black unity. The lack of respect, validation, interdependency, and self-realization would prove to become the black man's Achilles heel. And I speak about that in terms of black wealth would be the Achilles heel when you talk about black wealth, right? Okay, from WFDD, 1920s black owned safe bus. Said, we didn't have to ride in the back. It's a black bus, so black in the front is back in the black, black driving it, back owning it, right? It said during this, it said during, this is a strange story right here because y'all ain't going to believe it. During segregation, bus routes to Winston-Salem that brought workers to the city, major employees did not extend to black neighborhoods, right? So during segregation, bus routes in Winston-Salem that brought workers to the city's major employers did not extend to black neighborhoods. See, that's disenfranchisement, right? So, you know, you walk, so you walk, you late, you know, you, it's the impossible mandate, right? So it's making it, it's you know, excruciatingly hard for black folk to do what they're making white folks comfortable doing, right? So if it don't kill them, it's going to make them stronger, though. But I'm going to go home with this story. That often meant long walks to the main routes or trolley lines until safe bus, right? It was the state's first African-American-owned transportation company. It was formed in the mid-1920s to service the East Winston community, and it continued operating until 1972. When it became a part of the Winston-Salem Transit Authority, right? I'm gonna skip a little bit on this here. Safe Bus, right, was a black-owned, right, transportation company formed in 1926 to serve the African-American community, getting people to and from work at a time when trolleys ruled the roads, extending into white neighborhoods only. So the trolley, I guess that was upscale. Ride in the bus, which, you know, not, you know, I guess the bus wasn't all that. So my bus rides are, I don't see big deal. But that's not the way it is, right? Anyway, for years, these rides were provided by jitneys, small buses, and other passenger cars, right? Jitney, that's that thing you ride on and you ride somebody else, right? Or I think it's that thing they think Chinese have, you run and carry somebody. Anyway, some 24 independent jitney drivers fiercely competed for nickel fares in vehicles that were often dangerous to operate. So any robberies, altercations, and complaints to city or hall officials eventually led to an ultimatum: work together or don't work at all, right? So this is what the segregation kind of thing facilitated, right? And it led to altercations. That should sound very familiar, because we got that going in the black community right now. Certain conditions that's leading to altercation. I'm not excusing any behavior. I'm just talking about things that help facilitate that kind of stuff, right? So in April 1926, 20 of them agreed to merge services and form a company that would meet the needs of the underserved East Winston community, black folk. Facebook company stocks were sold at $100,000, were raised. Fares were set at 5 cents a ride, and the service began 1 month late. 5 cents a ride. I think we need to go back to that. These are good old days right here, 5 cents a ride. Anyway, many African Americans in the community then worked for R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, right? A lot of people back then was growing up walking. Says somebody by the name of Jamie Morrison. And then when the weather was bad, like during the wintertime and the cold weather and everything, we relied on the buses for transportation. That's good. Morrison said Safe Bus was embraced by the community for other reasons as well. For other reasons, right? The drivers were friendly, wore nice uniforms, and the riders knew one another. Another contributing factor rose to the top. We didn't have to sit in the back of the bus. Riding safe bus because it was owned by blacks. So, right? So by that time, Rosa Parks had helped ignite the civil rights movement. Safe bus had been in operation for nearly 30 years. Demand for service was strong. The short haul routes to densely populated East Winston, roughly 20% of the city, were highly profitable, and Safe Bus was hiring. All right, so very intimate bus company, right? That's what it seems like, right? So Safe Bus continued to grow. Its fleet acquired a Camel City Cab, and the black community took pride in the company's success. So it sounds like we have a black business, which is supported by the black community, not just financially, emotionally, actually, right? Socially, emotionally, right? So in 1968, Winston-Salem's contracted bus carrier left town. Safe Bus was told by the city to fill the void and provide transportation to all residents. That's all. That's black, white, red, green, everybody, right? This made it the largest African-American owned and operated transportation business in the country. Safe Bus formed out of the practice of segregation and eventually ended due to integration. Forced to cover the entire city, including non-productive routes, the lack of equipment, competition from rising automobile ownership, and a majority population not willing to ride black-operated buses meant the end of Safe Bus. In 1972, the city purchased the company's assets retained its staff. That's good, right? And it became the Winston-Salem Transit Authority, right? That's to this day, right? So the key here is, as my friend likes to say, faced with a common threat, black people were forced to work together. The illusion, delusion, or the euphoria of assimilation caused some black folks to seek what they thought was greener pastures. There were greener pastures on an individual basis, but the black businesses would be weakened while attempting to achieve the white standard. Big words are powerful.com, right? It went back to Claude Anderson, right? Dr. Claude Anderson grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Does that sound familiar? He grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And we were, I grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and we weren't looking for any social integration. Do you know why? It's because we had our own businesses there. My family had the only black bus line in the entire United States, the only bus line. So you see, that's corroborated by the writer here in from the WFDD, right? We had over 500 buses in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And guess what? We had that from 1927 to about 1967. In Winston-Salem, we, blacks, also had our own cab company, our own restaurants, own hotels, own school systems, shades of Umar Johnson right there, right? Your own school system, right? Your own accommodations, your own, more of your own resources, right? Excuse me. Do you know what killed our buses? Social integration, he said. When suddenly you all started talking about Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr. going down to Montgomery, wanted to integrate the bus line. Integrate whose bus line? White bus line. They didn't want to own or control the resources. They just wanted to sit in the front of them buses. Now, you tell me, what does that indicate, he says, that you want to get on the bus and just sit in the front of it? Now, if the bus is moving, then the back of the bus will be there, will be where the front of the bus was in a fraction of a second. And everybody gets off at the same time. So in Winston-Salem, we had our own buses. So when the movement was successful and the blacks who were in Alabama came to Winston-Salem, blacks in Winston-Salem said, and you ain't going to believe this because I didn't. Well, I believe it, but it's like, what? We want to ride in the front of white buses. We said, we don't have any white buses. They said, well, get some so we can ride on the front of them. Now, that, I don't know. That, to me, that sounds like children. Okay, so KenTakePage.com, right? I said, we had over 500 buses, and our buses served the black neighborhoods and the white neighborhoods. In our bus company, all the drivers were black. In our bus company, all the drivers were black. The mechanics, black. And the electricians, black. The administration, black. And we were serviced both the whites and the black neighborhoods. message. Anyway, that sounds like Black Wall Street to me. Talk about Black collective economics. How could the collect? How come the collective didn't see the value in supporting Black businesses? Why did they value riding on a white man's bus where he said they couldn't ride more than having, you know, their own bus line? The ultimate way to show the white man that you can do something is to do something independent of his influence and authority. Why not ride anywhere on a bus you want, eat anywhere you want, but supporting Black businesses where they are available? I get it. Black bus companies may not have been as prevalent as white bus companies, right? So you're going to get on that bus, and you're going to, you know, I get that. The Clark said they had the only one, right? Or that was really, you know, maybe somebody had a bus or something. I don't know. But not everyone had the luxury of a Black-owned bus company. I get that. I mean, I guess there's a whole lot of things that might come into play. But not when you have a Black bus company. You shouldn't, your concern should not be riding on a white man's bus, showing him how, like, nah, 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 I'm in the front of the bus. That's childish. Racism had hit us so hard that Black folk thought that it was if it was white, it was all right. And if it was Black, get back. Something's wrong with this picture. Do Black folks still think, some Black folks still think this way? When I say Black folk, I'm not talking about anybody. I want to make that clear. We have that conversation, me and a friend. We don't mean everybody. We talking about Black folk and you know, in general, some Black folks. So maybe I should say some Black folks. I don't want anybody to take me the wrong way, punch me in the mouth, they see me on the street or something. Anyway, so what happened? Because that is a sad story. That's a tragedy. From moguldoom.com, right? It's a quote from Claude Anderson. Excuse me. Any race that loves the world and hates itself will eventually become its own oppressor. All right, now we're going to apply that to what's happening. I'm speaking about Black folks tonight, so apply that to what's happening in our community. The violence, the drug selling, all of that stuff. My friend calls this getting in our own way. So, the Nipsey Hussle connection. I just want to give him an honorable mention because this is a brother that was where he wanted to be, doing what he wanted to do for his community. The late rapper Nipsey Hussle followed Dr. Claude Anderson's power economics principles, building and buying the block. The real solution to combating the ill effects of gentrification, right? That's when they raise the prices of your rent so high you can't afford to live there, but some other dude making more money than you can't, right? So you got to move out, and they move in. All of a sudden, your impoverished neighborhood becomes a middle, upper middle class or more neighborhood, right? So we know what happened to Nipsey Hussle. He was murdered. That brings us to another problem in the Black community. Should a successful Black man risk his life to provide for his community? A wealthy Black man in the hood is a wealthy Black man in the hood with a target on his back. It seems like a catch-22. A wealthy ex-gangbanger, two targets on his back. Should the community be helped from a farther, safer distance? Just a question. Just thought I'd ask that. Because there's a reason why people move out of certain communities. I mean, because just because you're poor, it don't mean you have to rob people, murder people, and assault people and things that be disrespectful, write on the walls and stuff like that. Take those talents to school. You want to write? Be a writer. You want to draw? Be an artist. Let the world see what you do. From Kentake Page. So it's one of my cardinal rules in power economics is, hey, of course, this is Claude Anderson, right? Excuse me. One of my cardinal rules, right, is never, ever, right, under any circumstances, support anything and anybody who won't support you, won't support you. The reason that's critically important is racism is a team sport. I'm going to say this again. Racism is a team sport. See the word race? Like to run a race, like you see in the Olympics, the 50-yard dash, the 200-meter, whatever it is, all of that stuff, the boat races competition, right? So people are competing, and people are in certain races joined together, right, to compete for resources for their people. He says racism is a team sport. You either play as a team or you lose by default, right? So this is a man that worked in government. He said racism is a team sport. So racism isn't going anywhere. It's a team sport. So if you want to play, if you're not playing as a team, right, you're going to lose by default because, like I said, one of the concepts of war is to divide your enemy. If you can divide them, you weaken them. Dissension or between any group will weaken the group, right? So disconnection is another form of dissension. So you do that to any group of people, they're going to be weakened. So all you folks out here and don't want to work together, can't trust each other, and I'm not saying we don't have reason not to trust each other, some people. But those who are honest people, those who have hearts beat in their chest, not ice, and those who don't need to change. I mean, we need to do something different. This is not working. I don't care how you look at it. All these brothers, every day somebody's getting murdered. Education not important to folk, young folk. They don't value education. Some folk do value education, find it difficult to concentrate on their studies and become the scholars that they truly are because of the, we're going to say, culture, the violent, aggressive culture in the communities which come into these schools. That's not playing on the team. All of that hurts the team. All right? Not knowing how to use your words. You know, and a lot of people say, instead of shooting, fighting, I say, fighting for what? We don't really need to be fighting, fist fighting. For what? You want to box? Train, be a boxer, go do your thing in the boxing ring. You can be a professional or not. But a lot of things you really don't need to be fighting. If you respect somebody and do make respectful decisions of another person's property, relationships, and things like that, we won't have a lot of the problems that we had. But I guess that's another show right there. And I'm going to keep going with the show right here, right? So, but that's a part of the show. I had to say it. And, you know, Claude Anderson goes on to say, don't support anything. No political candidate. Don't support anything. No political candidates. No political candidates. If they won't come and tell you what they're going to do for you specifically, right? You, right? You, right? Like they have laws for, they have gay rights, right? Or laws to support gay marriage. That's a specific law, right? So if they're not going to do something for you specifically, don't support them. I don't know how many times I got to say that. Don't support them. Forget about all that Democrat, Republican thing. Just look at everybody for face value. What are they going to do for me? That's what you vote for. You voting, you doing something for them when you vote for them, if you are a person that votes. So if you're going to get them your vote, get together collectively, right? And say we, right, are not going to vote for you. And by now, y'all should be able to have a list of, a laundry list of things that folks ain't did for you. And you can bring that up, too. You say, unless you're doing something for us, what you doing for us? And you better do it. Anyway, he said, he don't care. I don't care what you are going to do for minorities. And they say minority, they put you in the pot with all these people, these non-white folks or poor people. That's another big pot, right? That's some white folks right there, right? People of color, as they say, right? Oh, you know, melanated people. Handicaps, veterans, or senior citizens, or American Indians, or gays, or women, transsexuals, whatever, Martians, you know, men from the sea, whatever. You don't care about that. What are you going to do for black people? Never use those terms. Don't ever use those terms about people of color and minorities and all that. He said, crap, you do, right? Forget that stuff. Nobody has enslaved people of color. Nobody enslaved minorities. Nobody enslaved diversity or multiculturalism. They only enslaved black people. They must identify every person that has a common need, a common interest, and a common dilemma, and come together and build communities. Right now, we're tearing communities down. And we've been doing it for decades, really. If they can't build community, they must build a sense of community. Sense of oneness, right? Unity, oneness, togetherness, purpose, collective purpose, objectives and goals, right? I don't even know if anybody listening to what I'm saying. I don't even know. Sometimes I feel like I'm just talking in the air. Because it maybe was speaking to the, as they say, preaching to the choir. So maybe we had a conversation with some other folks. Anybody listening? We started changing the conversation at the bar, at the hoagie shop, on the ride in, on the bus. You know, I know we love to talk, you know, a lot of stuff, you know. We can do good at that, you know, but we need to change our conversation. Excuse me. He said, that's what power economics is about, right? So what the hell is community? I said, what is that? So community, the group of people living in the same place, that's a geographical area, right? Having a particular characteristics in common, right? It's also a feeling of fellowship, resulting of sharing common attitudes, interests, and goals. That means you can be a part of the community, right? And you can live not in close proximity to me. You still will be a part of our community, you know. So I feel that way about when I see brothers and I go somewhere and it's like it's just me and another brother there. I feel a connection with them, but I don't know if we actually connected. But initially, there is a connection there. You understand what I'm saying? So what we need to do is actually have an actual fellowship and attitude, interests, and goals. So we don't have to be clones, anything like that, but we have certain things that we're trying to achieve for each other.
Like I said, want him to succeed, and he should want me to succeed. He should want to know if I'm all right. I should want to know if he's okay. If you need anything, blase, blase, blase. Not that we hate other people. We should be trying to help one another, which is where we're going with this whole thing about segregation, desegregation, or what did we get from one? What did we lose from getting the other? And so forth like that. So that thing that we should have in common should be our thing. The characteristic of unity, each one teaching one, each one reaching one, helping each other grow mentally, morally, ethically, physically, spiritually, socially, and economically. Is that too much to ask? That's my question. The Black Detour. Was integration the worst thing to ever happen to Black people? And some people said, hey, that was the worst thing that could happen. It's like worse. I heard somebody say it's worse than slavery. And I'm like, whoa. And so I guess they mean that speaking, you know. Anyway, some experts have suggested that integration was the best thing that ever happened to Black folks, citing integration was not solely about being able to patronize white-owned businesses, attending better schools, or with more resources. It was about being able to move and access society on the same level as white people within America. So after segregation ended, Black people were cited to support businesses owned by white people and other racial groups. So I don't know if y'all heard about how money in certain communities change hands maybe 9 times and like that. That's how your community grows, right? That's how you build that sense of community. But they say in the Black community, as soon as we get some money, it's gone. It's leaving the Black community as soon as we get it, right? And part of the reason might be because it's hardly, I don't see Black stores in the community, in the Black community anymore. I remember when I was coming up, all the stores was all white. It's Italian guys and Jewish guys around here. And then all the stores became Black. None of those guys was around here anymore. And then poppy stores popped up, right? Those what happened was everybody started getting robbed, heroin, Monster, or methamphetamine, and people start robbing everybody. And I know those people just shut down. I think Ms. Tuck's held it in the longest. She's kind of protected in the neighborhood also. So nobody from the neighborhood would touch Ms. Tuck. Anyway. They believe they were missing out on something, right? So it was, going places where they couldn't be. So I heard somebody say one time that if you keep something from somebody, they kind of develop an interest in it because they get a curiosity, so they want to know. So, after living in a world where white people just had everything better than you, I could see why they would want to go. I get it. I get that part, man. And okay, you want to go open that store you wasn't allowed to go in. Hey, you want to see how white folks living? The ones that living better than you. I get all that. Because we do that now. We surf on the internet at these homes and we see how the wealthy live, right? I get that. But I don't get the part where we don't help each other. As a result, many Black-owned businesses, theaters, insurance companies, and banks went out of business. As a result, right, of Black folks' willingness, just having this excited about just, I'm going to this white theater. I couldn't go in there. We used to couldn't go in. Now we can go in. Oh, can't wait to line up to go there. You know what I'm saying? So the U.S. Census Bureau's annual survey of entrepreneurs says only 2.1% of businesses were Black owned in 2014. That's not a long time ago. So how are we going to create black wealth? We can't even create, perpetuate black businesses. We are perpetuating someone's business, right? And you might not think so, but apparently we are, because you would not believe our spending power. You're not going to believe it. Integration has not only hurt black people financially, subconsciously, it has caused many to believe that black people are beneath white people, causing many black people to lose respect and love for one another. Remember what Claude Anderson said about hating oneself? So hating oneself can be, this is one of the ways right here. I don't know nothing from it. If you look like me, I ain't going to any store. I'm going over here to this white man's store, right? For example, some discredit or do not support anything associated with black people, as I said, right? I said, talking about businesses, colleges, universities, communities, as they believe these institutions are inferior. David Banner stated on Sister Circle TV, I personally think that integration was the worst thing that ever happened to black people, even more than slavery. Now, that's a hell of a thing to say. Ultimately, there's a slippery slope in the idea that everything white is somehow better than anything black. Are we there? Is that where we are now? Whether it's in the school, business, or simply people, believing in this ideology can be deemed as a form of self-hate, although there are some positive and negative thoughts surrounding integration, right? Because there's some positive things that happen with integration, right? There is only one overwhelming reality that we all face today. Black people must start to support one another and unite as people. I'm going to say that again. There's one overwhelming reality that we all face today. Black people must start to support one another and unite as people. All right? We're kind of late in the race, but better late than never, right? Seems like integration spread people, black people, thin and facilitated further division. Instead of learning to work together to own businesses, they sought to work right next to white folks. There had to be some cracks for folks to break off that way. From the Washington Post, black unity lost as rights advanced, they said. So what did black folks lose their mind when it was like the law passed out, you could be near white folks, you could be where white folks are, or you can access things that white folks access, even though they were still preventing them from accessing resources that white folks had access to. But we ain't going to get into that, because if you know your history, you know that continue, right, till today, to this very day. They doing this slick stuff, right? They said parents of the first U.S. black ambassador, that's Andy Young, I think, of the United Nations, didn't take morning walks in their neighborhood anymore, right? They say they were afraid of crime. People will knock you in the head, no matter who you are, said Daisy Fuller Young, whose son is Andy Young, right? Y'all know him, right? He was appointed to the United Nations in 1977. Yes, Andy Young. Dr. A.J. Young, senior, is a dentist, right? We used to enjoy those early morning walks, but, well, I guess things have changed. When the Youngs moved into their neat two-story brick home 31 years ago, theirs is one of the most comfortable black neighborhoods here, right? Home to black doctors, black pharmacists, college professors, successful small businessmen. Remember, he's talking about how the black people moving in property and it depreciates, right? Community life centered around Dillard University, prestigious black private schools. You would walk around the neighborhood then. It was for the Youngs and all their neighbors a proud neighborhood whose children grew up both confident and challenged. Both confident and challenged. Both confident and challenged. Two powerful forces came along in the 60s to change all of that. A federal highway and the civil rights movement, right? The new expressway knocked down the old oak trees and demolished the well-kept houses. The government basically destroyed the community, right? And I thought it was a law against that, right? The civil rights movement loosened the fabric of the community. Even as it liberated the members, it gave aspiring black families options that they had never had before. Even as it dissolved their old community ties, something was lost amongst the gains. This is an aspect of the last decade black progress rarely discussed in newspaper articles. Well, I found a couple of articles here, right? It lies beyond statistical measures, beyond the sociologist's jargon. It is a collection of perceived losses of dissolved human relationships, which inevitably accompany great social changes. Old neighborhood ties were broken as more mobile blacks took advantage of a less segregated housing market and moved into predominantly white suburban subdivisions like New Orleans East, right? The elite black schools, McDonald's number 35, Xavier University, Preparatory St. Augustine High began to lose their quality students to predominantly white schools. White schools are better, right? Thriving black Catholic parishes, which traditionally played a major role in black life there, began to lose parishes. They started to come to church. They went to the all-white Catholic churches, right? White is better. White is right. Right is might, chasing the white ghost, right? And I ain't talking about that that stuff you put up your nose, right? So, what happened to black folks? They lost their mind. This is the effect that slavery, Jim Crow, had on black folks. Some black folks, right? Because I don't mean all, right? I never mean all. We don't go to the same churches anymore. We don't live in the same neighborhoods anymore. We hardly do anything together anymore. We don't know how that can be avoided. These are the gains we fought for. They fought for it. So these are the things that they fought for separated them, right? Caused division, right? The gains are real. The Jim Crow segregation laws are gone, right? Young people who grew up under their them laws have gone on to high places, as Andy Young did, because he would have never, ever been went anywhere in the United Nations for the United States, right? Based on the segregation. So anyway, similar stresses of change have been felt in other major black communities, right? So question here is, Did desegregation destroy positive elements and role models in the black neighborhood now that the black middle class could move out into a predominantly white middle class neighborhood? Or did black folks who could escape or abandon living in close proximity to their impoverished or less fortunate brethren? Is that what happened there, you know, or is it both of that? Could be all of that and more. Any way you look at it, without this desegregation, it was likely it wasn't likely to happen, right? Without desegregation, right? These moves couldn't have been made, because you went to a white neighborhood and might have got lynched. You know what I'm saying? Tarred, feathered, you know, filleted, and I'm not joking. Think about that. Safety is the priority, right? Safety is, everybody want to be safe. The parents of Andy Young stated they were afraid of crime. That would be black on black crime, the same predatory issue we have today. Before we can move forward, we will need to have a moral, ethical compass. I'm going to say that again. Before we can move forward, we will need to have, develop, erect, protect, inject, respect, expect, right? All to have a moral and ethical compass. And I mean all when I say that. That's one time I do mean all. All. So that's a sad story to me. It's a tragic story that black folks didn't see the value of their own unity. From blackenterprise.com, segregation was never good for black people, not even a little bit. Not a little bit. Excuse me. Segregation was never good for black people. We were not better off during Jim Crow. Not even a little bit. Those who wax nostalgically about how we thrived during segregation and leveraged it to our economic advantage to support and sustain healthy, strong black communities are just straight up wrong. Woo, that's a strong statement right there, because he's saying even the unity that segregation facilitated, the people who use that to say, hey, we had something during segregation, he's saying you're wrong, right, for even for basically putting that up front like that, for talking about that lack, you know. And they call it who wax nostalgically, like they, you know. We need to stop romanticizing life for African Americans before integration. The overwhelming majority of black people were trapped in abject poverty, or at best, a fragile self, locked out of nearly every profession or industry where they could gain access to significant income and wealth, regardless of their level of education or social economic status. It said, we had zero legal protection or civil rights, essentially deprived of any legal means of protecting their assets or wealth, right? White people could come, take property, money, land, etc. from black people with impunity. What they couldn't take, they would destroy, right? Everybody knows about the 1921 race riot. That they call that a race riot. I call it a massacre, y'all. That's not a race riot, a riot. That's not what it was. It's actually a massacre at Tulsa, Oklahoma, Black Wall Street. Read about it. They had everything except a defense of their community. But, you know, keep that in mind, too. You need a physical, a legal, and a defense of your community. God willing, if people who believe, you need a spiritual defense. The educated and relatively wealthy, including many World War II veterans who tasted freedom in Europe, were lynched, right? Yeah, because those are the strong men. You always kill the strong men in war, right? Concurrent with the establishment and rise of the Ku Klux Klan. They must be re-rise because they were around long before this. In order to eliminate them as a source of economic competition and as a way to use terror to keep blacks in their place. Right? What they can't take, they destroy. Right? That's historic. That's not rhetoric. Right? So, the taking of property from black people with impunity is still going on. All this deed, snatching, stealing they doing right here in Philadelphia. People getting their homes taken right from under them. And in some cases, nothing is being done. That's what I'm hearing. I'm not in the court case, in the courtroom, anything like that, but I know one case in particular that's going on. So, the article went on to say that the vast majority of people who talk today about how much better all black people were doing segregation have lived most, if not all of their lives in the post-segregation era, after segregation, right? So he interviewed people who actually living in that area, and can't remember any of them wishing to go back to the way things were during segregation. Today, we operate with unequal protection and access as black people. They operated with zero protection and access, right? So point to the writer. But if only segregation was the only problem for a black man, it wasn't. White terrorists were a constant overt threat to the survival and quality of life of black people. Segregation was a product of or extension of symptom of tool of white supremacy. The point to be made is that during segregation, black communities thrived and some became wealthier than their white neighbors, as did Tulsa, Oklahoma, on Black Wall Street. Other successful endeavors, Rosewood, black bus companies, also thrive, right? Segregation forced black people to work together. People who work together succeed together. Many hands make light work. That is what segregation facilitated by forcing black people to live together, except they did not feed upon each other. They thrived on each other socially in these communities and economically, ultimately, for a collective objective. I'll take unity however we arrive at it. It goes on, the article goes on to say that those who correctly point out that circumstances are not substantially better for African Americans since integration than they were during segregation. He says, what did you expect? Just how easy did you think this was going to be? It has been only 54 years since the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the writing of this article, right? The system we're fighting has to change and recover from, including the trauma and damage of our own psyche and self-image. That I want to ride the white man's arms. Anything that's white is right, is better. White school, everything better, that's white, right? It took centuries to create that, right? Expecting dramatic change is less than a lifetime, and then saying segregation is better is exactly the mindset of the escaped slave, he said. Freezing, starving in the dark, scary woods, with barking hounds on his trail, and no guidance that he won't be caught. No guarantee that he won't be caught, tortured, and maybe even killed. Thinking he was safer and happier as a black slave on the plantation. I've never been a slave or runaway slave, but I'm pretty sure some slaves rather be dead than on that plantation. I'm sure there was some people that felt that way. So, you can make that statement if you want. But I don't know. I can't say. Some people rather die than be in certain situations. And there were such people on the ships coming here as after they got here and during slavery, after the so-called Civil War, and to this day. Some people just, you have to kill them. There are such people like that way. So I don't know why he made that statement right there. he ran away. You know what runaway slaves get. So he don't want to be a slave no more. He said that's not how it works. Integration may not be the answer, but there was no way around, no way to go forward without it. Segregation was a dead end, if not a prelude to near extinction. The dilemma Native Americans faced, right? They were segregated, they put on reservations, right? No matter how much we struggle with injustice and racism today, our better is in pushing forward, not going back to a nostalgic, selectively imagined, segregated past. And I had a little something to say about that. Desegregation did not change the hearts of racist white folk in America. Therefore, change comes slowly. ask for the big picture. It would help if more black folks to see the big picture. And us, are we in collective social economic unity, having an actual collective purpose or objective would actually be helpful. Riding on the front of a bus did not instantly propel black people to the head of society, but I guess it felt good sticking it to the right, the white racist dude, whenever, however you could. As previously stated, there were individual gains, but no collective gains for black people. There were losses. Black bus companies, as a direct result of the segregation and how black people reacted to the segregation, right? That is strange, but it's true. Yes, they were less capable of protecting their accomplishments, as many black towns were destroyed and many black people were murdered. Black people continued to be robbed of their homes and murdered after desegregation. Black folk continued to live in predominantly black neighborhoods too. Many continue to live in undeserved and disadvantaged community. That is not a reason not to unite to help ourselves. Just as two is greater than one, three is greater than two, and so on, black people united socially, politically, and economically are stronger than black people divided by individual gain, classism, materialism, or any ism. During slavery, the old Jim Crow or the new Jim Crow. It is not the segregation, but the unity, a product of the segregation that counts. There is nothing nostalgic about black folks today working to achieve a common goal, just as they did in an environment that was overtly harsher in the not-so-distant past. It behooves us to learn from the experiences, the successes of other black people. Black spending power reaches a record of $1.6 trillion, but net worth falls. CBN, right, says that, right? Net worth declined 14%. That is indicative of the lack of collective vision, objectives, and goals. We would have thought that a group of people could acquire who would have thought that a group of people could acquire so much money and have so little social, political, economic power? That is the power of divide and conquer, be it by social, economic engineering, integration, assimilation, and individualism or oppression. Black folk need to shake this curse off. It's like having the resources to build a boat and drowning in the flood because you never realized those resources to build an ark. You never utilized those resources to build an ark for everyone. The ark being large enough boat to survive the flood. So I'm running out of time. Just so you know, in 2017, Canada's gross domestic product was $1.6 trillion, all right? And we spending Mexico was $1.7 trillion, right? It is useless to argue if blacks are better off doing segregation than so-called desegregation. It is useless to take what you can use from the past when legislation segregated black, when so-called desegregation afforded black people to accumulate great spending power and use it to invest in black people. Nothing beats a failure but a try. Unity and purpose trumps chaos. The collective is stronger than the individual. Now we have the best of two worlds, the so-called desegregated world and black unity looking both behind us and forward to the future. Black Wall Street, Rosewood, and many black towns that have been destroyed or flooded are examples of black unity, black folks working together, each one reaching one on the road to prosperity. That is not nostalgia. That is just smart, all right? I'm going to end on the poet Noor. We cannot allow the spirits of our brothers and sisters to be corrupted by the evil ones. We must not sacrifice our brothers and sisters to them, nor must we suffer to sacrifice ourselves to bathe in their iniquities. Rise because we must, or die because we prefer to lie within the belly of the beast of the world. And with that, I want to say thank you, anybody who called in, anybody who's downloading the show. I want to thank We Talk Productions, Blog Talk Radio, and Mr. Kenneth Jones, and all my listeners and callers. Until next week, each one, reach one, each one, teach one. Peace out, y'all.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on Deport from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.